Now, we've been working with this subject of love. Great problem in the religious community today is that for so long a time, people have thrown words and phrases around without ever knowing what they mean, that we've gotten into sort of a trap on the matter. Now, one of these is this word love, you see. Whenever anyone mentions the matter of Christian love, right away there is an assumption that there has got to be some kind of manifestation of that, in some kind of a feeling. If we go to pray to God for love, we're expecting something is going to happen. We don't know what. But that's a problem. We don't know what. And it varies so much from psyche to psyche, from person to person, that there's no way to differentiate it. How much is too much? How much is enough? What do we mean by love? Just what in the world do we mean by love? When you apply it in the English language, good grief, you apply it to hamburgers and dogs and books and whatever else is around. You can apply the word love. What do you mean? How do you differentiate it? What difference is there in what is said about praying for love among the brothers or saints or Christians or whatever, versus loving hamburgers? What's the difference? How are you going to differentiate that to people? Will they feel the same thing? Using the same word. But you can't differentiate what people ought to feel because that's too personal. Now, see, if I may seem to be very pedantic here to break it down, remember this cardinal point, absolutely essential point. The Bible never used the word love, ever, from one end to the other, because it was written in Greek, and because it did not have one covering word for what we call love. Now, if I stop down and start defining the way I've got to define it, then I may appear to be too much in the mind, as a lot of people have said that about my ministry, and too mental about it. But you see, if I don't stop down now and ask and try to sort this thing out, I'm not giving you what the Bible says. Now just keep that in mind. The Bible never uses the word love, because it never uses a covering word that controls all aspects of the emotion which we call love. It's like the Eskimos never used the word for snow. Did you know that? I don't think there is a word in Eskimo language for snow. A covering word. Because there are too many different kinds of snow, and because their lives depend on it, what kind of snow it is, they have a different word for every kind of snow. So they never just say snow. You know, they say whatever has to be defined to keep them alive. So whether it's soft or hard or packed or pack powder or whatever, they never just use a covering word. And the same is true with the idea of love, because it's too general a term. So you see, the Greeks understood or had a difference, and those differences were used. Of course, we have differences too, but we never used them in the Bible. You could, in English, get down to cases, as I have done for you. You could get down to cases, but you'd use probably several words, as we would have to do for our words about snow. See, we could describe snow in the English language. We can do it, but we have to use phrases to cover it. So I'm really not doing any disservice to the Greek texts when I refuse, basically, to cover everything with the word love. But I'm doing a great service to you. Now, the differentiation is shown precisely in Greek, to a very large degree, in one statement that is what they understood by the concept. Was shown in one statement, which I may have quoted before because it's so crucial to the understanding of these words, from Cicero in regard to Caesar, writing in Greek, he said words to this effect. I'm not sure I got the precise quote, but it is, agapesete hos archon, aphelesete hos pateras. You know, I may not have it precise. Archon means ruler. You have respected him as a ruler. The word agape is used there, which is the same word that is used in the Greek text commanding us to give attention to, consider others, respect others, and so forth. The next clause, aphelesete, you have had affection for him, hos patera, as a father. Now you see, if you came along with a typical English translation, you'd say you have loved him as a ruler, you have loved him as a father, and you would not have had any differentiation. You wouldn't have known where you were at. So that's why I stopped down and pull this stuff apart. And say, let's look at it, because I'm trying to get below the surface. Because, by and large, the aspiration, or the goal, I should say, perhaps, that is set before believers in regard to the matter of love, by and large, has been a failure, has been unachieved. Now, I interrupted myself. Let me go back to this thing of grades of feeling. There are some people that have gone through so much hell, they've been battered and badgered enough that by now they're almost insensitive to pleasure or pain, see. They just make it through. All they want to do is just make it through. And these people can be steady and they can survive, and it's marvelous that they survive. Many people within the body of believers have not suffered that deeply to be sympathetic with that kind of thing. We've had our problems, yes. But there are some people for whom catastrophe has been so devastating that the human emotions are pretty well reamed out. But that doesn't mean they don't care about Christ or about anybody else. It's just that they don't get very excited about anything. And they probably don't get too low about it. They just chug along. But people have been reamed out emotionally. Sometimes their only way to survive has been to blanket the emotions because it'd be too distressing to them. But you see, all the while I'm talking to you about human feelings. I'm talking to you about the Greek word phile, which has to do with human affection, with friendship, with family relationships, but never in all the Scripture commanded as such, but as agape is commanded. Now you have real difficulty with passages, I mean, where you start mandating family affection, for example. You have great difficulty with passages where Jesus says, if you don't hate your mother and father, and come and follow me, you're not worthy of me. Well, obviously he doesn't mean to have bitterness toward them. He means to reject the family connection. But how do you reject the family connection without at the same time, in some respects, having to abandon feelings about the family? In some respects. If you're in a situation, as many of us have been, where the family has totally rejected you, you can't spend too many nights whipping up warm emotions for your family, right? You have to go on. You've got to do your job. That has got to be a closed chapter, and you've got to leave it alone. Many of God's servants have had to do that because the family has not agreed with their ministry or their way of going, and they've had to just cut it off. Does that mean they don't care anymore? Of course not. I know deeply how all of this works. You can care deeply, but you don't stop to analyze your feelings about it. You relate to them in the Spirit, and you know that if there's a need and they ask for your help, you'll be there. You know that. That's the caring side of it. The feeling side of it is so vacillating, so undependable, that you don't dare put too much weight on it. Now, on the other side of the coin, that doesn't mean you can't have such feelings. It doesn't even mean that they do not exist among believers. There was a lot of brotherhood, a lot of fraternal interaction with the believers. And often the agape love promotes the phile love among believers if there are no conditions to the contrary. And groups of people have a great affinity for each other, and they develop affinity. We have a gang living down there at our outfit, that if they don't develop some affinity for each other, they're going to have a pretty tough time because they live in pretty close quarters. And they do develop affinity. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's hardly something God has mandated. Agape love does not necessarily by itself exclude feeling. You could have agape love with some feeling in it, but it doesn't emphasize that. By the same token, philia love does not exclude necessarily caring, but that's not its emphasis. The Greeks have a third word, although I have many words for conditions of the emotion, but a third word is eros, which has to do with physical love. We get our word erotica from it, or erotic. Autoerotism is self-love. But mainly, that's an English derivative. But the erotica, the word eros in Greek, in fact, the god of love was Eros. Romans called him Cupid. And eros just means physical love. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you could only, that physical love can never, can only exist as physical love. It has elements of all in it, or it may not have elements of all in it. Eros may be purely physical, or it could combine the other elements. So it isn't an easy distinction to make, but the only place it isn't easy to make is in the flesh, the natural self. In the spirits, thank God we don't even have to make the distinction. We don't try to take apart the meaning of the love of God, particularly, and try to practice it. The caring of God shows through and emerges. We may hinder it by our selfishness, and a lot of other things may get in the way. But basically, the caring love or caring consciousness, I said last week, what agape really has to do with is others' consciousness and God consciousness within our spirits. Now, that takes it pretty much out of the emotional realm. And all of us here in the room, all of us, can attest to a God consciousness thing. You know, we're not sure always how we feel about him, but he's there. And we can all attest to an other's consciousness. We have a sense of others. We're not just indifferent to others. And I see it emerging almost automatically in cases of people who've come out of the world, out of a more or less godless background. Immediately, the first thing that happens almost is they beginning to care about others, the family or someone else, try to express their help and caring, usually almost invariably by praying. Many, many people I've seen, it maybe hundreds, that have come to Christ raw out of the non-Christian context through our ministry, through Bible studies just like this, or someone has brought one or whatever. I think almost the first thing that happens is to start praying for a brother or a father or mother or whatever. And that does not require an application of feeling. It requires only being. Being what? Being possessed by the Spirit of Christ and not being able to help ourselves from being conscious of Him and concerned. Now you step out of that pure, crisp air of the Spirit and into the fluctuating limbo of human feelings, and you're in a jungle, and feelings wax and wane, and they rage and they subside, and they ebb and they flow. Feelings about others, feelings about yourself, feelings about God. You get on the merry roller coaster of human affections and emotions, and there you go. It's up and down, up and down. It happens in terms of family matters, in terms of husbands and wives, for example, where you've got a period of time where they just can't keep away from each other, couple, young couple. They get married, and then pretty soon they're trying to find excuses not to have to come home or whatever. And one day you feel great, and the next day you've got a flat spot. There are people with flat spots on their emotions, and they just don't feel anything. So one day the person may be very warm and affectionate. The next day they're kind of cold. Why? Well, they hit the flat spot. They come with physical problems, with cycles, with any kinds of things in the human body and in the human mind. There are cycles of things. There is probably some truth to the fact that our own psyche goes in cycles, that there are some high points and low points in the general cycle of our month. But I wouldn't put any weight on it. Don't put any money in those biorhythm machines. They're just a waste of time. But it is obvious that we have our cycles emotionally. And then, of course, we alter even the natural cycle by our nutritional activities, for example, what we ingest, by circumstances around us, what is happening to us, the environment, oh, so many things. It's such a complex mass of things that affect our feelings that if we don't cut them off from the reality of the spirit, in a measure, we get on the roller coaster. Now, the only thing I'm saying by that is you do not put the weight on them. I'm not saying you do not have the emotions. I'm not talking against emotions. That would be absurd. I'm not even saying that emotions are not helpful or admirable in the faith. I'm saying, again, don't put any weight on them. Your weight is in the crystal clear purity of the Spirit of Christ within our spirits. He knows where He's going, He knows what He's doing, and He's got things under control in the Spirit. It's in the realm of the flesh that we're fighting the battles. How you feel about God in your natural emotions has very little to do with what exactly is going on in your spirit. Now, looking at the thing of feelings, we can get even more technical. In some ways, I hesitate, and yet I have to do it. You see, incidentally, once again, we have been sometimes bit with the bug that Bible study has to involve a steady outlining and academic assessment of the text. What I'm saying to you here is very biblical, but it's got to be also very technical, given our state of affairs, given the fact that we haven't come through with a pure language. Maybe when Paul wrote his words out to the Corinthians and to the Ephesians over, and he used his words of agape and feeling and so forth, they knew right what he meant. But we don't know it today, and we've garbled the thing so much. Of course, in our day, we've put a lot more store by emotions today. In those days, they didn't put that much stock in emotion. They couldn't even afford to feel a whole lot. I mean, these women were sending their husbands off to war almost upon marriage and some of those communities, societies, and they wouldn't see them for 10 years. You can't get really very emotional about a husband who's over in Troy for 10 years. Right? The Spartan women couldn't get a whole lot of involvement with their children because when their child was 7, he was put into the army at the age of 7, given his military training and raised to be a soldier. So the Greek mothers used to say to their sons as they went off to war, come back with your shield or on it. That's right. In other words, if you don't have the guts to keep your own shield, I don't want to see you alive. You know why they came to that? They used to be a very soft society, the Spartans. But they had slaves they accumulated. They called them helots. And these slaves began to increase in number. The Spartan society was very loose, profligate, like Rome became. And the helots got together and rebelled. And the Spartans came within a whisker of losing their nation. Following which there was the famous Lycurgican Revolution. Lycurgus was a philosopher of Sparta, and he aroused the people to realize that since they had nearly lost their nation, it was more important for them to completely reverse their culture and to become now a military culture instead of a social culture. Now, you come swinging in there with a nice romantic concept of how we feel nice about each other. You're going to have trouble. So I say, you know, in those days they didn't even think like we do. We've been affected by novels and movies and things like that that they never had access to. In those days, most Greek plays, dramas, were tragedies. The more tragic, the more it fit with life. Oh, those are terrible plays. If you read the plays of Aeschylus and some of these others, they were tragic things. But I'm just saying that these feelings we keep talking about relative to God and each other and so forth have evolved with culture and civilization rather than being native aspects of the psyche that God has ordained or is cultivating. And yet, I have to say at the other side of the coin, I'm not saying you can't have these feelings. I'm not saying you ought to be hard and cold. I'm just saying that the mischief comes when we try to put weight on feelings, insist that people have to feel a certain way. And again, when Paul said to husbands that they should love their wives, so the husband, you see, was not ordained then to feel great about his wife, or vice versa, but to take care of her. And the kind of love that we write about, or people write about in their books on romance and marriage today, that kind of thing was just non-existent in the typical family of Greece between husbands and wives. There was eros, or there was agape, and not much in between. And as I said last week, I think those marriages were arranged. Nobody proposed his wife in the moonlight under a cherry tree. It was an arranged thing, and the two people came together and fulfilled their responsibilities, and they didn't even ask the question. In the Greek society, there wasn't even a word for it. And a woman would not wake up in the morning and say, "Do you really love me, hubby? If you do, will you make me a pot of coffee? And if you really love me, you'll go out and fix that door or mow the grass or whatever." They never talked like that. They didn't even ask the question. And I say, you don't even ask the question, "Do I love God?" Because the way you'll assess it is from the corny combines of human affection, which we devise in our brains. Everything in the external environment, everything gives off a signal. It's like a radio wave or whatever. It gives off a signal. That's called a stimulus. A plural is stimuli. When you see a table in the room, light from the light source, and now a lamp, reflects off of the surface. Energy waves from the light bounce off of the surface to your eye. Energy waves, impulse. Same thing that's going through that electric cord is going through the air to your eyeball. Registered on the retina, picked up by the rods and cones of the nerve endings, and transmitted by radio signals, transmitted back to the occipital lobe of the brain, and the surface there has picked up the information, the data. It has been integrated in the file system and interpreted. But all the things that you know about tables are instantly integrated, much greater than a computer, because instantly you recognize the table by putting together hundreds or sometimes thousands of fragments of knowledge already recorded. If you didn't have those fragments, you wouldn't know what it was. So you should eat it or wear it or put it on your head. In Haiti, I've been in the Caribbean there a bit, and the missionaries introduced wheelbarrows to the natives. And the first thing they did was to load the wheelbarrow up, put it on her head. Pretty strong people. See? Why? They did not know a wheelbarrow from a hole in the ground. They didn't know what a wheelbarrow was. Maybe something to mix a stew in or something for a crowd. They had no knowledge of it because there was no data on their cortex. There was no data in the file system. Okay, so that's the mechanics of feelings. Now, feelings are the response of the nervous system to the stimuli from the external environment. And how you respond, because you send out then signals. The signals have come into you. And you send out signals by what you say, what you feel, how you move your arms and legs, whatnot. And you send out vibes of feelings. It all depends on what's in the file system, right? If you have negative information there, your vibes are going to come out negative. The difference between cutting your finger with a knife or having an unkind cut from somebody that you know, a remark that cuts you, you see. Same thing. The signal, this time you pick it up with the ear. You hear the words. They go by impulse through the nervous system, just like an electric cord. There's a process there, positive and negative field. moves the impulse along the nerve, and by the process of potassium and sodium exchanging back and forth through the walls of the nervous system. See, this, what this is very technically sound. The impulse moves along the nervous system of that cut, that unkind remark, goes from the ear, in this case, a short distance to the cortex, where the data is registered. Now comes into play a whole lot of different complex factors. What you know about people. What you know about this particular person. What your emotional makeup is. What you receive by heredity from your parents. Some people are more sensitive to pain than others. We call it the threshold of tolerance. Some people jump through the roof if they prick themselves with a pin. Other people can stand a considerable amount of pain and never even think about it. Makes a lot of difference. Now, suppose you were to take a needle in hand right now. There's your finger. You take a needle in hand and stick it through the finger. Not too many people would want to do that, right? It's not a common thing we appreciate. Now, every morning of my life, I have to take a needle and stick it into myself with this insulin. I say, I've got to develop a pretty stable sense of what is involved. If I don't hit it just right, I raise a bruise, which I've got right now here. I just missed, and if I put it into the blood vessel, I go into a coma, see? So when I stick it in, I've got to pull the plunger back to be sure that I'm not in a blood vessel before I push the stuff into it, before I inject the stuff in. And if you slip, then you pull a needle out, and the blood spurts out. I mean, see, if you... So anyway, it's just one of those things that you go through. I do this every day of my life. Now, if I would have a fit every time I stuck myself with a needle, I wouldn't last very long. Okay? Now, that's what we call threshold of pain. You can cultivate that matter. For example, if you've got a problem with yourself or your children in an injection, just think in terms of a needle slipping through the fibers of cloth. See? When you start to stick it in, don't think of yourself cutting anything. Just think of the needle slipping through between the fibers, and that'll make it a little easier for you. Second thing, do it fast. But all this is threshold of pain. Now, some people have a lower threshold than others of pain. Okay, now, the same thing is true, though, with psychological pain, right? Some people are more easily hurt than others. It's their psyche, it's their makeup. There are some respects in which they can cultivate a little more tolerance, a little more toughening. By nature, if their genes have given them that hypersensitivity, you're not going to help them by pounding on them. You know, the idea of saying, well, you ought to be able to take it. Well, who knows what a person ought to be able to take? Who can say? We just simply have to be sensitive ourselves and to watch it. One of the great tragedies in marriage is the amount of damage that is done even by friendly badgering, by friendly teasing. I see it, however I see it in couples that I know well enough to do it, I'll talk to them about it because they can get in the habit. Now, for example, a guy that's been in the service or been with a gang of guys a lot, they throw charges back and forth all the time. It's just part of life that they throw cuts back and forth. They chop each other. Now, you take that into your marriage and start chopping, and you're going to do some damage. You're going to have some problems. Even good friendships have their limits. And the problem is you never know where the limit is. See? There's always that perilous point of no return, see, where you hit too hard or cut too deeply. So the only real answer is to be sensitive to others who are sensitive, you're not, and just go in the kindness of Christ and leave that to the jokesters and the punsters. They got cages for them. Just be careful. But can you get a slight sense of how much complexity there is to this thing we call feelings? And we want to walk into a meeting somewhere and we think everybody's got to feel the same thing. It's idiocy. I cannot think about. I can think of stronger words I can't use, but it is rank idiocy for Christian people to run around playing with the emotions like that. Let people feel what they want to feel. They want to feel joyous and bubbly. Fine, that's their privilege. They don't want to feel that way. It's idiotic to try and make a spiritual judgment about it. But don't make spiritual judgments about how you feel. You never know. You know, there's so many things. Feel what you want, but don't put any weight on it. If you like your faith with feeling, enjoy. Be my guest. Fix a banquet up for yourself and gorge. If you like to be calm and quiet and unexpressive and unresponsive to those things, fine. You'll learn over a lot of years. Nothing's ever really that good that you can get too excited about it. But that's all right. Some of us have become, over many, many years of much badgering and many beatings, a little bit cynical about life. But we're just as much in God's favor as those that are very joyous about life. And for my own part, one thing I've always had difficulty with is the idea that Christian people can so easily forget the tragedies of the world and just go for the joy on the basis that, well, it's not happening here, so let's just be joyful. And see, joy in the spirit is a different thing once again than happy feelings in the flesh, see? You can have deep joy in the spirit and yet be cognizant of the stark tragedies around you. That's where you've got to watch it. There are people tonight in deep tragedy, and I care about those. You care about them, I'm sure. We all care about them. And I'm not sure that in this world it's all that appropriate to be handling our church thing like a circus. Well, anyway, that's another subject. Feel what you like, but don't put any weight on it. That's what we're saying. Well, I'd better stop. I'm going way over. Father, we ask that you will give us sense and sensitivity to what life is all about. Minister to our spirits beyond our own capacity. In Christ's name, amen.